This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Back in black.
Oh, and let me be clear. Danielle, did you just call Bloomberg Lucifer?
Of course not.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now please join me in welcoming my co-host, a man who might be the next Redskins quarterback, Rick Hess.
Hey, Mike, how you doing, babe?
I'm doing pretty good. So what about a pretty smart deal the Redskins have made there, huh?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Everybody wants to get an over-the-peak, mid-30s quarterback who you've just benched in the last 2 minutes for a cheap $78 million.
Yeah, yeah. I love it. Love it.
It's a well-run operation.
What is this? I mean, why can't the Redskins make good decisions?
I think Dan Snyder is trying to bring educational fiscal management to the NFL.
Ah, I see. Ouch. That was nice. That was like a nice...
Boom.
Rick, always finding a way to tweak the education establishment.
Mike, you look a little sick there. You sounded a little sick.
Yeah, I'm definitely feeling under the weather. I've had this cough for what feels like weeks now.
Is it colic?
I don't think it's colic.
I've wondered that. Is it
whooping cough, maybe?
Ooh.
No, I don't know. But I understand that you have the same cough.
I do.
Which makes me wonder, how did we both get it?
You know what? I think I was on the verge of getting better when we did that 4 a.m. night in Nashville.
Oh, yeah.
So I think I blame Mike Johnston.
Well, he is definitely to blame, no doubt. And yet, you know, the next morning, you and I both looked very hungover, and he looked fresh as the morning dew.
He does have that knack. Mm. It's... Mm-hmm. I wonder if he cut a deal with the devil.
Okay, well, we could ponder that, but frankly, I don't feel well enough to do that. So we're going to keep going. We got a lot to cover.
You know, I'm so sick, I can't think of any of those cool devil nicknames. I was going to go with like a Lucifer or something.
Uh-huh.
Do you remember in Angel Heart that De Niro's character's name? Remember this?
I don't think I've ever even heard of the
Lewis
movie Angel
Cipher.
Heart.
You don't realize... Oh, Mickey Rourke? Are you kidding me? Lisa Bonet?
No.
But you don't realize till the very end that Lewis Cipher is Lucifer.
Oh,
it's crazy stuff.
That's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
Liking it. Okay, lots to cover. Let's do it. Pardon the gadfly. Daniela, get us started.
Much like Lewis Cipher would rock your world, how about Mayor Bloomberg? He has selected a total education outsider, magazine publisher Kathy Black, to lead New York City's public schools. Both of you support placing non-traditional candidates in leadership positions. But is this a bit of a bridge too far?
Back in black.
Well, wait, let me be clear. Danielle, did you just call Bloomberg Lucifer?
Of course not.
But Mike, you quickly went to the back in black. So now I'm wondering if there's a theme here at Fordham.
Yeah. So what do you think here, Rick? Kathy Black, a bridge too far?
I don't know. I mean, I love the idea of bringing in people from inside K-12 when you've got challenges where you need inside the sector expertise, and people from outside K-12 when they've got the right expertise. Nothing that's been communicated by the mayor's office explains to me what her expertise is that they think she's going to bring to the challenges New York's facing.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like they picked out some random successful executive at this point. And that doesn't sound like the smartest way in the world to pick talent.
Boom. Look at you. You're getting a little critical there. I haven't seen you write that on your blog post yet, on your blog yet.
Unlike you, baby, I don't put every thought on paper. I do one a day. I got to get around to it.
All right. No, look, I think this. There's a lot of questions about how this went down. I mean, it does appear that Mayor Bloomberg just had this idea pop into his head that he should hire Kathy Black. Didn't seem to be much evidence that he considered other candidates, that he consulted almost anybody before offering her the job. And, you know, Is this just going to give mayor control a bad name? It says, you know, here's a mayor. He's a lame duck, term limited out, but he can just go and do whatever he wants and pick somebody who's, you know, probably not all that qualified for the position.
But here's the crazy thing. I don't know that she's not qualified. You would think the mayor's office, in given this kind of appointment, mm-hmm. would have gone out of their way to explain what it was about her that leaves her well-suited for this job.
Right.
And I just haven't seen much of that kind of explanation.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm hearing you. Okay, topic number two.
Okay, we're still in Gotham. How will Joel Klein be remembered? Is he a role model for other urban soups?
All right, Rick. So have you gotten around to this one yet? I mean, Joel Klein has only been there for...
You guys beat this to death.
I mean, Rick, what do you write your blog post like 3 weeks in advance?
He was resigned for 12 minutes when I think you guys had like, you and Checker had something out on NRO or Fordham or something. Yeah, celebrating it. And especially being like, Joel is awesome. We love Joel.
We were pretty positive at that point. Look, I think when in these circumstances, somebody's leaving, you know, there's no need to tweak them. I mean, look, on the whole, I think that his legacy is very positive.
I agree. No, I think Joel did a lot of really good things. I think it's important to remember that New York had been churning through a lot of leaders without much direction for a couple decades when Joel got there. You know, and I think he's laid a lot of building blocks in place. Problem is, I think there's this reputational game where, you know, it's kind of like with coaches, you know, in college basketball or something, where there's a handful, you know, there's a handful who are there forever, which we really don't get much of. And the rest of them, they're in favor, they're out of favor, they leave the job, people pile on or romanticize them. You know, there's this big study taking place right now, Kempel study, looking at, I think, 13 papers, trying to look at different elements of the Klein legacy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they might be useful, actually, at this point in terms of giving folks some context and what to make of it all.
Right. You know, of course, New York City came out number one in our big study of the best and worst cities for school reform. I'm sorry, not number one. Number three. But still, close to the top.
Pretty good.
One of the top three. And
Joel was a huge factor in a bunch of the variables that got him up there.
Yeah. I mean, you know, so he was a mag. You know, said, look, we want to become a magnet for entrepreneurial thinking and leaders in this space. We want to be the Silicon Valley of education. And many things that he did were around that. Now, you know, the one thing that we would always tweak him for, and I think deserves to be tweaked on, is that he made some bad decisions, especially early on around the curriculum and pedagogy stuff. You know, he sort of lost Diane Ravitch and some of that crowd, you know, forever with some of those decisions. And that's the risk. You know, does Kathy Black get it that there are these big wars in education that are so ideological and that, you know, a lot of this depends on who she trusts, who she comes down to respect.
But, you know, we've seen this with the legacies of Page, of Burson, of Payson, of different folks. You know, Page, there were these Rand accusations regarding dropout rates and such, and in Houston schools, regardless of how that actually was sorted out empirically and what the actual explanations were, people use these things to kind of remember and folks in a certain way.
Yeah.
Even though I think Carl Cohn followed Burson and only lasted 18 months, the legend has been planted that Burson was very conflictual and couldn't move things in 7 years in San Diego. So, I mean, I think part of it is there's this reputation building which takes place kind of independent of, you know, the good that these folks actually accomplished.
Okay, topic number three.
Okay, last question. NK wants to turn teacher preparation upside down. Is this new focus on clinical practice a big deal or the same old ed school malarkey?
Same old ed school malarkey.
Oh, Mike, you're tough.
For 200 points, yes.
How can you say that? They had a 27, 28 member Blue Ribbon Commission.
Oh, yes, I know, with some luminaries in the field.
And led by friends of ours, Dwight Jones, Nancy Zimpfer of SUNY.
I don't know any of those people, but I'm sure they're fine people. I don't get around like you do, Rick.
But what are your concerns with it?
Well, look, I mean, I think, you know, as far as it goes, it's fine. It says that we need to have teacher preparation be more based in clinical experience, less theoretical, more on the ground. All of that's fine. But it's not all that revolutionary. And there's nothing that makes me think that these report recommendations are going to lead to any actual change. I mean, it's, maybe this is typical for these kinds of reports, but, you know, education schools should do X, Y, and Z, and states should do this, and so should do that. And I just don't see it happening.
I think, I mean, my own concerns are really two especially. One is that what I see them is talking about a one-size-fits-all preparation ideal. Mm-hmm. Everybody needs to go in, get clinical supervision, be subjected to instructional rounds, the rest of it. And it strikes me, if we're talking about citizen schools, if we're talking about online instruction, I'm not sure what we need is one-size-fits-all mindset. And the second thing is they point to terrific boutique programs, the Boston Teacher Residency, which seems like a really neat thing. I have zero confidence that you can actually do this well at scale. I don't think there's enough good classroom mentors. Right. I don't think there's enough good supervisors. I'm just not at all convinced that this pretty expensive, pretty time-consuming process is going to actually deliver terrific selection and instruction, and not just a whole bunch more pretty mediocre student teaching.
I mean, the big question, and you point this out on your blog, is that do we even need the universities to be in the center of this enterprise? I mean, if teachers learn the most on the job in these in this kind of clinical experience, then why is the university in the middle of all of this, getting most of the money, calling all the shots? I mean, it seems like school districts should set up their own preparation programs, or they should contract with nonprofits to run these things, or charter school groups should do this. You know, in short, you could hire some some professors to do a course here or there to participate in some way. But, you know, the whole model that says we're going to have kids come in and pay their tuition and use their student loans so that it goes to the ed school and then they parcel a little bit of that out to the school. I mean, it just doesn't – it's crazy.
Hello, high tech high.
Yeah. No, exactly. High tech high, where the charter school where they now have the ability to train their own teachers. Mm-hmm. And that to me seems transformative. That's a seismic moment. Just saying that we're going to try to do, you know, more stuff in school and less stuff on campus. I mean, yeah, fine. That's good, but that's not revolutionary.
You know, and a point that keep coming up, I was discussing at the launch of the NCATE report today. They kept saying, hey, these are selective programs. We're, you know, being careful about who we take in. That's terrific. But the concern is, I don't suspect that they're going to be as selective and boutique-y when it's not Boston Teacher Residency working with one district or Long Beach, but when you're talking about every ed school in California, or when you're talking about every district in California doing this. I think the care and selectivity tend to decline, and I don't see anybody in that commission, and I don't see any evidence in the report that they really wrestled with this in a serious way.
Mm. Not enough wrestling. That's the bottom line from Rick Hess. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's all the time we have for Pardon the Gadfly. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Welcome back to the show, Amber. What you got for us today?
Thank you. Just trying to stay away from the germs over here.
Amber. Just
lots of cold germs, sneezing and coughing.
You know,
going
Rick and I are always
here.
Hugging and kissing each other, so I wouldn't worry about it.
Scary.
Germs are life. Germs are things, too.
All right.
They have little germ
on
families.
On that note...
Are you anti-germ family values?
Mike is so over it today.
Although, you look at the blue on his face out of the microphone, it makes him look a little spooky.
Amber, give it to us straight.
Let me give it to you. All right, so we've got Education Next new annual survey out. They do this in collaboration with Harvard's Policy Shop. As usual, some interesting findings in the winter issue. This was a nationally representative panel of adults, roughly 2,800 of them, responded to the survey this summer. Four findings. The public appears willing to support more spending on schools until it becomes clear that their own community will foot the bill. 63% favor an increase in government funding, roughly the same level in 2008. But when asked whether local taxes to fund public schools in your district should increase to pay for it, only 29 support that. Charter school support is steady, but two groups have sort of changed a little bit in their perspective. Support among minority communities is rising. About 64% support them in 2010. This is up from 49% in 2009. Opposition among teachers has risen. We can kind of expect that. Support among teachers fell from 47% to 39% between 2008 and 2010. A couple other quick things. Support for online learning is growing quickly. 42% supported it in 2009, and the public support grew to 52% in just 1 year. And finally, the analyst examined divides between Republicans and Democrats. A couple interesting twists here. More Democrats, presumably due to support for private school choice within the minority communities, supported vouchers. A little bit more than the Republicans did, actually. Democrats also more likely to support tax credits for education expenses by 60 to 53% margin. And a couple things on teachers unions. 19% of Dems say they have a negative effect on their community schools. 50% of Republicans say the same.
So, well, a few nuggets. And just now, just for readers who might be confused, didn't the EdNext survey come out like in September or August?
This is the winter 2011.
So yeah. What's
so
going
this
on here?
One, maybe this is a different cut. I mean, you guys are hello, editors.
Well, that's what I'm
looking at each other saying. What?
I know we came out in August because I remember that.
It says winter 2011 on the article.
Huh.
All right. Anyway.
Well, they do. We do sometimes do sort of interesting cuts and reanalysis.
Yeah.
And,
so maybe it's like an additional analysis on a survey that you already.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or did we just release it online and it's just now getting printed?
Maybe. But here's the big question. Vouchers, that's interesting. I mean, so we've always assumed that suburban Republicans probably aren't big voucher fans because they've already bought into their public schools and paid for them through their houses and things like that. Is that what we're seeing here, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, that was sort of the big takeaway, I think, that they really, you know, fixated on is that this is unexpected. You know, we've got more sort of minority communities, you know, presumably supporting vouchers as, mm-hmm. you know, and supporting kids going to those schools. So, yeah, I thought that was quite interesting myself.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it continues to astound me that anybody's surprised by this, right? I mean, if you buy a house mm-hmm. for access to a school, you actually, not only does choice not do anything for you, it's actually a threat. Because if any other people can get schools, it means that your house is going to lose value.
Mm-hmm.
And it means that the access that you were 100% sure of is now going to be less than 100% sure because mm-hmm. you don't know what effect it might have on your school in terms of population mm-hmm. or teacher retention. So, I mean, the fact that anybody is ever surprised by this is just...
Yeah.
Strange.
You know, Checker and I had an interesting meeting with Dan Domenech the other day, the head of the AASA, the American Association of School Administrators, used to be the superintendent of Fairfax County. Mm-hmm. We're talking about the days, you know, before his tenure ended there in Fairfax County when the Supreme Court decision came down barring racially based admissions policies for magnet schools and things like that. And so this was a big impact in Thomas Jefferson High School, the nation's mm-hmm. best high school. And at the time, it was, you know, relatively diverse. They'd had various ways to make sure that happened. But then this new law, Supreme Court case seemed to say that you had to have totally colorblind admissions. Well, he proposed that I guess Fairfax County is divided up into something like 12 different judicial districts. And mm-hmm. so his proposal was to still use the test to get in, but that the top applicants from each district would get in and each district would get a proportional amount. Well, you know, parents just went nuts over this. Mm-hmm. That first of all these parents from the wealthy part of the county, Great Falls and McLean, said this is terrible because our kids, you know, right now, most of the kids in that school are from those areas and they wouldn't get as much. The other thing I would imagine is that, you know, again, people who own houses in Great Falls and in McLean, if suddenly you said, if you move here, your kid will have less of a chance of getting into Thomas Jefferson than if you live in a different part of the county, mm-hmm. it could actually have an impact on the housing market.
Mm-hmm. And given that 80% of homeowners don't have any kids of school age, you know, in fact, you know, we always talk about this in terms of parents of school age kids.
Right.
But 4 out of 5 homeowners don't have school-age kids. Mm-hmm. What they have is a house that they paid for fair and square.
Right.
And so anything which is threatening to dilute the value of that house, perfectly reasonable for them to oppose it.
Okay. All right, Amber. So what song goes along with this?
Since teachers are fired up and hot about charter schools, we have Van Halen's Hot for Teacher.
Yes. Rick, I bet you were a big Van Halen fan back in the day.
I dug my Van Halen. Were you a Sammy Hagar guy or a David Lee Roth guy?
Oh, I liked them equally. I don't remember which was which. Who was the first one?
David Lee.
Right. I think I did see them in concert, though.
Sammy Hagar,
I think it was after. I think it was. I saw them in concert with Sammy Hagar.
Hagar was the poppier one.
Yeah. Is it because he was better looking?
No. Like that was when they did like softer stuff. That's like when they did 5150.
Okay. Yeah.
I
think that's when I got involved.
Love Comes Walking In. Love Comes Walking In.
Like loving that. Loving it.
I don't think I really hit that so much.
Wow, that was amazing.
Thank you.
All right. Well, now it is time for our favorite new segment, What's Up With That?
Mm-hmm. Telephone rang and you wanna chat? Well, sit on down and tell me what's up with that. What's up with that? Yes, sir.
Chris, welcome to the show.
How's it going, Mike? Rick?
Frankly, I like Chris's voice.
I do too. Frankly, I'm not doing well, as our listeners can tell. I just don't feel well.
Dude.
I feel like there's this like dome of unhealth around me.
Dude, you know what this is?
What?
World's littlest violin playing whatever song that is. Little violins play when they say that.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Step up, man. There are teachers out there sick every day trying to make it happen for their kids, trying to be Superman and Superwoman. And here you are in your fancy DC office building with your warm water and your scarf and your padded chair whining about a little bit of cough.
You know, Rick, in Ohio, do you know that teachers get 15 paid sick days a year? 15. Okay, 3 weeks. And these are for employees that only teach, you know, 9 months out of the year.
But, Mike, they teach the winter months.
Well, and those are harsh in Ohio. Okay, Chris, what's up with that?
All right, well, let's stay right there in Ohio. But to start, let's talk about, is there anything you would camp out and wait in line 4 straight days for?
There's got to be something, Mike.
Maybe tickets to the Super Bowl for the avid football fan?
U2 concert, maybe.
Tickets to La Boheme, especially if I was in a balcony.
For the Eduwonk, maybe even a signed copy of Rick Hess's new book?
Yeah.
I think the last thing on the minds of most people would be camping out for a spot in the pre-kindergarten program at Fairview Clifton German Language School for their child. Fairview Clifton is arguably the most coveted magnet school in the Cincinnati Public Schools District. And believe it or not, by 7 p.m. on Friday, November 12th, there were 92 families in line for the 73 spots available for the next enrollment period, which didn't begin accepting applications until 12:01 a.m. on Tuesday, oof, November 16th.
Oof. Wow.
How out of control has the supply-demand curve for high-achieving schools gotten in this country that parents have to camp out for half a week to get their child into a pre-kindergarten program? Looking at the pictures, I half expected to see wizard-dressed fanatics peering out from the tents, waiting for the premiere of the next Harry Potter movie, as opposed to delirious young parents. How is it that this Cincinnati magnet school has not come up with a more efficient way of determining who gets the spots at their school than holding a survivor-style endurance competition? Unless the principal happens to be named Jeff Probst, Fairview Clifton needs to wake up and realize that they are not Best Buy and this is not Black Friday. People have lives to live and should not be subject to standing in line like drones for nearly 100 hours while the district stumbles around trying to figure out how to revamp the application process. Has not one school official seen waiting for Superman? The word is pronounced lottery, people. Fairview Clifton German Language School, what's up with that?
Ooh, you brought it today, Chris. I like
that's
that.
That's good. And you know what I love is that Chris didn't go for the, oh, we need more good schools. There's not to that's true.
Right.
But there's a very practical, straightforward problem here, which gets overlooked among all that stuff, which is why in God's name are we making 92 families spend 3.5 days standing in line when we've got these fancy technological innovations that let them maybe send an email saying they'd like to be on the list?
Mm-hmm. You see, I think you guys are both missing something important here, which is by making these families go through this arduous process, you're creating a sense of commitment that you wouldn't create otherwise.
You're also screening out a whole lot of people, which you might not.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, these families have got to be committed. They've got to have discipline. They've got to have perseverance, traits that they likely have passed along to their four-year-olds.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Makes your job as a school a little bit easier.
Mm-hmm.
Or a lot easier.
Don't really envy the parent or the teachers that have to deal with these 73 crazed parents willing to wait in line for countless days just to get a spot.
These are hardcore parents, I'll tell you.
Yeah, very nicely done. Well, all right. Well, this is good. I'm glad this segment's working out well, Chris.
Excellent. Glad to hear.
Yeah. And we'll re-up you for another couple
of days. And it's only partly the voice. It's partly the caliber of his inquiring eye.
Yeah.
And it's partly the quality of his writing.
Yes.
This young man's got talent.
He's got it. He's going places.
Well, mm-hmm. If I can get a contract like Donovan McNabb's.
Mm-hmm. You're going to have to leave Fordham first.
All right. That is all the time we have. And I have to say, we are not going to be here next week because it's going to be Thanksgiving. Oof. And frankly, we're not sure anybody would really care about listening to Education Gadfly stuff when you could be eating turkey and watching football. So until December.
Whoa.
I'm
Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, coughing and signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.